Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boomer Debate Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And yes, indeed, it is the Boomer and the Babe Show one more time here on Blog Talk Radio. It's Wednesday, July 20th, 2011, and we're broadcasting live from our Boomer and the Babe studios in Phoenix, Arizona, and right from the site of the Feeding Arizona studio in Youngstown, Arizona. We'll be getting to our guests in just a minute, but before I do, I want to invite our listeners to visit our website at www.boomerandthebabe.com. Sign up for our free online magazine, take a little tour around the site, and see everything that the Boomer and the Babe Enterprises are involved in. Also, follow the link to the new Entrepreneurial Revolution site that we have up. Join the Entrepreneurial Revolution. It's absolutely free. Start uploading your blogs, your videos, and so on and so forth, and helping entrepreneurs from all over the country lead the charge into making this a better economy for everybody. Everybody knows it's on us to do that as entrepreneurs. So if no one else is going to do it for us, if it's to be, it's up to me. So that's one thing that we've got to take care of. And I'm Pete Peters, and Deborah Brown is not here. She's, as I say, on assignment when she's not with me. But today my guest is Brian Frick. Is that Frick or Fricky, Brian?
We say it Fricky.
Okay, Brian Fricky, I'm sorry. He's president of Financial Management Concepts, which is a financial service, and he has an office in Orlando, Florida. And he's got all kinds of people there to help you with your finances, and he's going to help us by answering some questions and having conversation with us today. Welcome to the Boomer and the Babe Show, Brian.
Glad to be here. Good to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you, believe me, because in these times, as things are going on right now, it's hard to get a handle on it sometimes as far as what we're going to be doing in the future. Boomers are running out of money. They got not enough money to probably take care of them their whole life, and they're possibly contemplating not retiring or going back to work, starting businesses, and if they do that, we like to help them with that. But nonetheless, it's trying times. Why don't we just get started, however, with what Deborah would call the two-minute movie, and go ahead and give us in about 2 minutes a little laser beam sketch, if you will, of who is Brian Fricky and how did you come to be talking to me on the radio today?
Sure. Well, I guess first and foremost, I'm a fee-only certified financial planner. The company is Financial Management Concepts. And in a nutshell, our mission is to help our clients, help folks put their financial lives, their financial house in perfect order and keep it that way forever. I got involved in financial planning really back when I was a teenager. My father died when I was 16, and my father owned just a typical real estate brokerage firm, helping people buy and sell houses, just a local realtor. Well, my mom was forced to take over the business. She had no options because my father did not have adequate life insurance, and the family fortune, so to speak, was wrapped up in just this business. So I got my real estate license when I was 18. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I had 20, 30 rental properties myself. People started coming to this 20-something for financial advice, and that's when I took an interest in this thing now known as financial planning. And I went around town and interviewed anybody and everybody that at the time called themselves a financial planner, and was really kind of disappointed. I found that it was either a group of people that were insurance salespeople in disguise wanting to sell you the latest insurance policy, life insurance policy, and not much more. Or back then it would have been the tax shelter limited partnership salesperson, and once they had all your investment money, they were off and on to the next one, and that's not really my view of true financial planning. You need to have all the pieces to the puzzle, so to speak, to make sure that you can live and enjoy life on your terms. And then since then, I've a couple of years ago wrote a book, Worry-Free Retirement, Do What You Want, When You Want, Where You Want. And today, you know, folks will ask me, well, Brian, when are you going to retire? And, you know, I kind of tongue-in-cheek tell folks I think I already am retired. My definition of being retired is really just being in a place where you're, for the most part, able to do what you want, when you want, where you want. And for some people, I would be one of those. You know, working is something that I want to and do, want to do. I enjoy doing it. Sometimes I wonder who created the 5-day work week and the 2-day weekend. I think they got it in reverse. It ought to be a 2-day work week and a 5-day weekend sometimes. And in fact, I try to kind of walk that talk during the summer. My schedule is just that. I work 2 days a week, and then I'm surfing and fishing and enjoying my 5-day a week weekend.
Well, that 5-day a weekend, 5-day a week weekend plan certainly sounds like a good plan to me. I think it's something that Deborah and I are striving for, but we're not quite there yet. Although we do enjoy, and much like yourself, we do enjoy doing the things we do. Of course, this radio show being just one of them, but we enjoy getting involved with other people in their businesses. And as regards doing them doing their business, we try to help them in their endeavors along those ways. That way is also, and it's also very rewarding to us. And I think that has to do a lot with it as far as being a baby boomer is concerned. There are several ways to live your life. And there are several of us that will never retire. We'll write our order. As I used to say to Deborah, we're going to write my last order when we're taking us out 10 toes up. And that's probably okay, too. But for those that don't want to do it that way, they want to have maybe a little bit more, shall we say, traditional type of retirement. But they are, let's say they're 55 or 60, and they haven't really started to save yet, haven't really started to put any things away. Is it too late?
I guess the best answer to that is it's never too late. You got to get started sooner or later. So if you haven't gotten started, get started now by all means. And the fact of the matter is, the longer you wait, the more you have to set aside if you want to pursue that traditional retirement, so to speak.
But when you're putting your plans, helping people put their plans together, and they are going to continue on in some form of employment, whether it be their own business or working for somebody else, how do you plan that in and figure that in as far as what they need and what they already have achieved and how much they can live that semi-retired, for lack of a better word, lifestyle?
Yeah, well, with us, and this is what makes us, I think, a little bit unique. You know, I think most financial advisors, it seems like, say the same thing. You got to save more and more and more, and you got to be frugal and set every penny aside that you possibly can. Our approach is a little bit different in that it really starts with having a clear vision, a clear understanding of exactly what it is you want and what you want to do, how you want to live your life, and what it's going to take to accomplish that. So first, you just need a clear picture of what it is you want to accomplish, what you want to do, how you want to live your life, and part of that then becomes how much money is that going to take, and then back out of that, known income sources. So are you going to have a traditional pension, you know, work for a company forever, get a monthly income the rest of your life kind of pension? Do you have that? What about Social Security? If you're going to have another business or another job, part-time or not, what kind of income and for how long do you expect that income to come in? And then the difference is met with accumulated savings and investments from retirement. And once you know what you need to withdraw or would like to be able to withdraw from investments, then you can develop an investment strategy. And again, here's where we view things a little differently, in that know and understand what you need to withdraw from your savings and investments, and then develop an investment strategy that exposes you to the lowest level of risk possible while still having, you know, a reasonable expectation of being able to reach and keep all your retirement goals. So with us, you know, the lower the risk profile, the better off, instead of all these, let's fill out a risk questionnaire and see how much risk you're willing to take, and by golly, let's put something in place that pretty much guarantees you're going to experience that, including the volatility and the losses that go with higher risk. So,
you mentioned in the course of that comment, you mentioned Social Security. It's certainly in the news right now. Is Social Security a high risk or a low risk form of revenue, number one? And number two, would you advise people to take Social Security when they can first get it at, as an example, age 62, or should they wait until 66, 67?
So the when to take Social Security answer is going to be different for each individual. But first, as far as, you know, is Social Security at risk? I certainly have worked with folks and that have come in and said, well, from a planning point of view, I don't want to rely on or count on Social Security. I think that's the safer approach to go. And then if there's anything left for me or if I end up collecting anything, that's just icing on the cake. And that's certainly a philosophy that somebody could use to develop their retirement strategy, if you will. But if you do that, you might be shortchanging yourself. You might be making lifestyle sacrifices that you really, in the end, didn't need to make. And the reason I say that is I have a hard time personally thinking that Social Security is just going to go bankrupt and nobody's ever going to get Social Security benefits. What I think, regardless of all the rhetoric in Washington, is I think it would be a political time bomb for our politicians to take Social Security away from those folks already receiving Social Security. Do I see them changing the Social Security system going forward? That's going to have to happen if they're really serious about dealing with budget deficits. But I don't see them taking Social Security away from anybody. Down the road, I can see them pushing back the retirement age before you can collect Social Security. I could see them putting in some kind of a means test, an income or a net worth test that would reduce what you receive from Social Security. I mean, when you think about it, you know, some of the ultra rich folks in America today, what, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, are they going to really miss their Social Security if it doesn't come in? I don't think so. But in fairness, I think they ought to be able to pull out of the system at least what they paid into it. So down the road, that's what I'd like to see happen. You know, people that have significant wealth, you get back what you paid into it, but that's it. And then other folks, receive benefits according to their situation. And maybe we need to push back the age. When Social Security was first enacted, I think the average life expectancy was age 65. So if now, thanks to changing, improving health of America, if Social Security were indexed to increased life expectancy, I think full retirement age for Social Security would have to be increased from 65 to 70. That's just taking into account increased health care or health longevity. As far as the ideal time to take Social Security, you can, of course, take Social Security as early as age 62, but for every year you wait, you get an increased monthly benefit all the way up through age 70, and those increases really amount to about an 8% per year increase in your Social Security benefit. So one way of looking at it is by waiting a year, it's kind of sort of like earning 8% interest on that investment. The drawback, of course, and the answer that no one has a question to is how long are you going to live? Because if you opt to wait until 65 or even age 70 until you collect your Social Security benefit, and then you know a health issue or an accident takes you out, so to speak, before you turn 65, you're not going to collect or get anything back from Social Security at all, whereas if you would have started at age 62, you would have gotten something. The other issue, of course, is at 62, are you still going to be working? And if so, is your income going to be high enough that it would require you to give back most or all of your Social Security benefit? And if you're in that boat, then it most definitely makes sense to wait until 65 or until your earned income falls below the threshold amounts.
So now if somebody starts and takes their Social Security at age 62, and if at age 65 is when they would be eligible for the full Social Security payment, between 62 and 65, those intervening years there, they're still working. They have to limit their income as to what the regulations are at Social Security as to how much they can actually earn. But when they get to 65 or the first year available for them to take the full Social Security benefit, at that point, then can they earn whatever they want to earn?
Yeah, that's kind of, to me, that's the crazy part of the Social Security rules. Once they hit that age 65, or for some folks now it's age 66, once they hit that age, then there is no earnings limitation. You know, go out and get a $1 million paycheck, and you still get your Social Security benefit.
That almost sounds a little convoluted to me.
It does to me. You would think it'd be the opposite way around, but what can I say? It's a government agency. I've yet to figure out a government agency.
It is what it is, as they say.
Yes.
Not much you can do about it. Well, when you were introducing yourself, you mentioned something about low risk. Is that a great part and parcel of what your total investment philosophy is, low risk?
Yes, in a nutshell, our investment philosophy is only accept or assume the level of risk necessary in your investment strategy in order to reach and keep your financial goals. In other words, why assume more risk than is necessary? So I guess really in a perfect...
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, so in a perfect world, we all would have a low or a no-risk investment strategy. And for most of us, that simply and unfortunately isn't going to be possible because we don't know how long we're going to live. Inflation is here. Regardless of what the government puts out in the CPI number, we all have our own personal inflation rate that we have to contend with. So prices and the cost of living and enjoying our lives continues to go up, and that probably isn't going to change. So we need to have some of our money invested to keep up with, if not outpace, inflation, to park everything in a truly no-risk investment strategy. Typically, those investments don't keep up with inflation, and if that happens, you end up like my grandparents. my grandfather passed away in his mid-90s. That he had no financial issues because he and my grandmother still had money in the bank, so to speak. But my grandmother, she died broke because the money ran out. It's just plain and simple. And they never did anything other than bank savings and certificates of deposit. And when I asked my grandmother, you know, later in life, hey, what happened? She said, well, nothing happened other than we didn't think we'd live this long. And if we'd have lived to the ages we thought we were going to live, we'd have had money left over and people would have inherited money. But who knew we'd be living into our mid-90s? And again, this is back 10, 15 years ago.
So they just outlived their money, period. And that seems to be happening or possibly setting itself up that way for many baby boomers today, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
That they have the potential to outlive their money?
Absolutely. You know, my grandparents, their financial strategy was what I call the go broke safely strategy. While they never showed a loss in their bank statement per se, they weren't able to keep up with the cost of living with inflation, so they went broke safely. Kind of, you know, we've all heard the story. You know, the frog in the pan with the water boiling, and if you start off with just room temperature water and slowly and surely increase the water temperature, the frog stays in the pot, gets boiled, and dies. But if you put the same frog in the same pot that's already boiling, you know, he knows he's got to hop out. The water's too hot. So
the situation with the economy the way it is today, I guess it's safe to say that it's unstable. Would you say that it's unstable? Would that be a good word?
I think the economy, quite frankly, is more stable than what we're being led on to believe or that what it feels like. Financial markets certainly don't like uncertainty. We've seen that in the last couple of days with the stock market gyrations, just with the uncertainty over the debt crisis. But when it comes to the economy, you know, contrary to what it feels like, we're seeing businesses do better and better. They're not hiring yet in at the levels that we'd like to see, but most businesses are doing better now than what they were doing back in 2008. There's always pockets that are going to be doing a little bit worse or a little bit better, but by and large, it seems like it's better in spite of what's going on in Washington. I mean, not to get too political, but golly, if our fearless leaders in Washington would really get their act together, the economy could be, you know, twice as strong as what it is now.
Well, they certainly do seem to be toying with it, I guess, is maybe not exactly the right term, but do you really think that they're taking it to the brink the way some of the pundits and the talking heads say they are?
Yeah, I would have to agree with that, to the brink, in terms of the deadline, the August 2nd deadline. We got to get this figured out before then, or the world as we know it's going to stop spinning. And yeah, I would agree with that. And I think I've seen some other pundits say, you know, gee, if you want to get the issue resolved today, just move the deadline to today. I think from a political point of view, both sides, all the politicians, they're just using this to posture themselves for the best political posturing they can do, and they're going to wait it out until the very end, and then miraculously, you heard it here first, miraculously, they're going to come and announce to us that, you know, they fought long and hard against the opposition, but through their efforts, they were able to hammer out and negotiate the best deal possible in spite of what the other guys were doing, saying. And that piece never seems to change.
No, it doesn't. And I think we're all a little worse for wear because of it. It's very tiring to hear it all the time. And it's kind of the case of, why don't you just quit talking to the cameras, quit your posturing, and just go get something done for a change. I would very much like to see that kind of an attitude, without gloating, without putting the other person's ideas as if they were nothing but poison. Everybody's going to have to give something here. There was a term haircut not that long ago, and everybody's going to have to take one. Well, if everybody's going to take a haircut, well, let's go take the haircut and move on.
Yeah. Yeah, but if everybody's going to take a haircut, then I want to see what they're giving up, too. They need to participate in this, too, not just in the rhetoric. Where are you sacrificing financially? You're asking me to, as a taxpayer, you're asking me to sacrifice by paying more taxes, perhaps. Okay, I get that. Where are you in Washington? Where's your sacrifice coming from? What are you doing about it? And certainly some of the spending programs need to be reined in. I forget the number. I think I read this correctly. The current leadership in Washington, 92% don't have business experience.
I think that's probably correct.
Yeah, so no wonder we're in the mess we're in. Yeah, good grief. Yeah. Any business owner knows that you do what you can to get the money coming in, increase your income, increase your revenue, and then if that's not enough, then as any other business, except the business of Washington, any other business, you cut expenses. Is it fun? No. Do you like doing it? No. But given a choice of staying in business or going out of business, you cut your expenses. That's what a business owner does. And
that's very true.
It's disappointing that we don't have that many business owner types in Washington. We need more business owner people.
At the risk of getting us into more of a political discussion than maybe you or I even want to get into at this point, do you see, with your knowledge of finance, do you see a tax increase on the most wealthy as a logical way to do some of this revenue enhancement?
Is that the way to go to really increase revenue? No, that's not. But probably that's what's going to happen. And the reason I don't think it's the way to go is when you look at the wealthy, most reports we've already read, what is it, the wealthiest people in America, depending on how you define wealthy, are already paying 50 to 60% of the income tax liability. So you're just going to ask them to take an ever-increasing role in that. Well, if they do that, they're going to cut back their spending, not just their personal spending, but typically wealthy folks have business interests. They're going to cut back on their business, which is going to affect their employees in one form or another. Whether it's freezing wages or cutting salaries or cutting positions, it's the American free enterprise system and the marketplace that creates wealth in America. It's not bigger government. That's not the way out of the issues that we have. But in the end, I do expect that there will be somewhat of an increased tax to go along with a spending package, and that'll be the compromise of one form or another.
Well, it amazes me that one side says A and the other side says B, and they're both equally wedded to their side of the issue. I don't understand whether or not it's actually the case that although they may have a 60% tax rate, they don't pay it, obviously. It's obvious to me, based on what I've been hearing people say, they don't pay it because they've got all the tax loopholes. Is that being able to know about taxes yourself, is that the case?
No, that's not the case. When it comes to an individual taxpayer, these days, more and more people are paying higher and higher taxes because back to the Tax Reform Act of 1986, taxpayers now have actually two ways to calculate their income taxes, the regular, ordinary tax way, which is how most people end up calculating what their tax liability is. But then we also have to deal with this insidious thing called the alternative minimum tax, which was created to make sure that the wealthy and those that in the past had paid zero tax were forced and made to pay some level of tax. So I don't see the ultra wealthy escaping personal taxation. Now, we both probably have read where there's issues where corporations have sidestepped paying corporate tax.
Right.
But again, there's another argument again to whether or not you even need a corporate income tax. And I would argue that the corporations don't pay corporate income taxes. You and I do, in the form of higher prices from the goods and services the corporations sell or provide us. So in the end, it's individuals that pay all taxes. It's not corporations.
Do you think that this dilemma has an opportunity at any point of ever being totally resolved, so that we can all just move on and say this really isn't as bad as we thought it was going to be because we've made the adjustments, or things are right with the world because we made the adjustments? Do you think there's any opportunity for that here?
Absolutely. Call me the eternal optimist. I think the good that comes from this time of uncertainty is it seems to be drawing more and more people into the discussion. More and more people are taking an interest hearing about what's going on. And part of that perhaps is thanks to the internet and technology and the way things have evolved and how much easier it is to get good, reliable information in a timely manner. And armed with that information, I think more and more people, what's that term, the silent majority? Well, I think the silent majority is starting to become the vocal majority. And over time, I think their voice will be heard louder and louder.
Well, what would be your advice to the baby boomer generation in this economic situation that we're facing right now? What would you generally, or could you generally advise them as to one, two, three, maybe four things that they should be considering when they're looking at retirement, when they're looking at investment, when they're looking at any aspects of their financial life?
Yeah. Great question. The first one, I guess, is really don't worry about things that you have no control over. So first and foremost, don't worry about what Washington is doing. Take an interest in it, but don't worry about it because, you as an individual, as it relates to your personal situation, have little, if any, control over it. So focus on the things that you have control over. What do I mean by that? Well, you have control over whether or not you spend money or save money. So, the first step would be certainly make sure that you have a rainy day emergency reserve fund. A good starting point would be 3 to 6 months of living expenses. And the reason for that is simply, not if but when one of life's emergencies pop up out of left field that nobody expects or anticipates, you're not forced to sell an investment to get the money to cover that unexpected event. Because if you do, Murphy's Law prevails, the market's going to be down, and you're not going to be able to get the price you want for whatever it is you need to sell. So have an emergency fund. The next step, of course, is you want to be debt-free. Get rid of your credit cards, get rid of your car payments, buy and pay for everything in cash. Our government could take a lesson from that. That's what's causing so much pain for more and more people today is debt. Think about where you would be and where we'd be if most people had little or no debt. And then as you get close to retirement and in retirement, you should make it your goal to own your home free and clear, no mortgage payment at all. And the reason for that is real simple. Back in the 2008 financial meltdown, the stock market meltdown, clients of ours, just looking at our own clientele, those clients that already had no debt, including a mortgage, compare those to clients that still had a mortgage on the house. I don't need to tell you which group of folks slept better at night. Everybody was still a little uneasy and uncomfortable, but it's obvious. People that had absolutely no debt to contend with were sleeping better at night then, and they still are today.
Do you think the financial situation that has been called recession here at this time, do you think it is truly a recession, or is it closer to depression?
We are far from a depression in the sense of what the country witnessed back in the late 20s, early 30s. Just in simple terms, back in the Great Depression, unemployment was, golly, 25%. Today, unemployment is in the 9% range, and I don't think it got higher nationwide. I don't think it's gotten higher than about 10 or 11. So I think we're a long way away from being near or close to a depression era event like the country has witnessed before.
Every time there are tough times or tougher times or however you want to term it, there are people that find themselves in a bit of a jam financially. Some of them may be friends, some of them may be relatives. What are your thoughts about helping some of those people out if you have the wherewithal to do so?
We're taking more and more of those questions from our clients these days as well. I say it all depends on the situation and the circumstances, and here's what I mean by that. One of our clients called us up a while ago. Their son, grown adult son, couldn't make his mortgage payment that month. Well, he'd been out of work for almost a year, and they just wanted our opinion, should they help him make the mortgage payment for a month and maybe for several months to come. So in a situation like that, I would caution folks as to whether or not they should really help folks and by giving them money. And the reason for that is really twofold. First, before you give anybody money to help them out in a short-term jam, you want to know and understand where you're at financially. Will you be jeopardizing your financial future now or into the future if you were to help somebody out? So the first step is you got to take care of yourself so that you're never a financial burden to anybody in your family. Even if you've got the financial wherewithal to help somebody out, I'm going to suggest oftentimes you would do that person more harm than good. You might be treating the symptom and not the cause of the problem. So if the person that's needing help has done nothing constructive to improve their situation, then I would say, yeah, you're just going to be enabling them and you're going to deprive them of the opportunity to rebuild their own sense of self-esteem and self-worth that comes from getting yourself by yourself out of a jam. And just so in this situation with the son, you know, his mortgage payment problem, that didn't happen overnight. He's known for a year that he's out of work. He's had opportunities, I would argue, had opportunities to make money, to handle things on his own, whether it's stay in the house, sell the house, or whatever, he's had opportunity to take action on his circumstances, and he chose not to. Well, that's his fault. He needs to fix that problem. He didn't walk into the problem overnight. Maybe he's not going to walk out of the problem overnight. You know, different than if somebody just had a, I don't know, a medical catastrophic accident type of event overnight. So, again, it all depends, but I would caution folks, don't be too eager to rush and lend a helping hand. You oftentimes may be taking away from that person a sense of independence and self-esteem that they'll find very difficult, if not impossible, to recover from later in life.
In all of the investing advice that you give to your clients, how does or does it all does at all real estate figure into the mix? I know here in Arizona, as an example, you could buy some really sweet deals on a house because of the way things have gone into foreclosure and people lost their houses, unfortunately. And although it may sound as though it's taking advantage of somebody else's misfortune, the bank, that's already been done by the bank, but the house may be there and able to be purchased at a reduced rate. How do you feel about using some of your investment dollars to buy real estate in this market?
Real estate makes sense, but like any other investment, you have to be extremely careful in what you're doing. And if at all possible, this may sound a little crazy, pay cash. You get some wonderful bargains if you're in a position to pay cash. One of the mortgage brokers that we recommend to clients was able to buy a foreclosed home from the bank. They were selling it for, I think they had it listed for $170,000. Well, he walked into the bank with a cashier's check for $90,000 payable to the bank, and said, "Hey, I'm going to be leaving in 30 minutes. Mr. Banker, your decision is, and the only question you need to answer for me is, am I leaving with my cashier's check or am I leaving with the deed to the property?" And because he had the cash, he ended up walking out with the deed.
It's interesting you tell that story because I just had occasion to speak with somebody at one of our networking groups that we attend. Matter of fact, just this morning, where this woman and her husband found a house here in Arizona, a three-bedroom house here in Arizona, in what I believe to be a pretty decent area for $68,000 cash money. And it was just absolutely amazing that some of these houses are available for those kinds of prices out there. But, you know, the old money talks and, you know, what walks, you know.
Yes. Yes. Well, and if I'm not mistaken, my friend, I think he had told me the bank actually had turned down other offers for higher prices because it was contingent upon financing. And that's one of the things we do tell our clients. I would tell anybody thinking about buying real estate today as an investment, make your profit when you buy, not when you sell. In other words, make sure you've got the good deal going into the property. And then, especially if it's housing, even if you've gotten the steal of a deal, you need to make sure that not only will your buyer, you got to be looking at the end game, I guess, is what I'm saying. So when you go to sell your investment property, are there going to be buyers that are able to qualify and get a loan to buy the property? And at least in our area, will the property get a reasonable appraisal? We've seen some crazy things with just some I just can't explain the logic behind some of the appraisals we've seen. One of our clients a couple of years ago, maybe now, wanted to refinance their home. They weren't looking to pull equity out of the house. They just wanted to get a lower interest rate on their mortgage. And their loan application was turned down, not due to their income, not due to how much money they had in the bank. The home did not appraise for a sufficient loan-to-value balance for the loan. Well, the appraisal that this guy gets, they live on a beautiful lake over an acre of property. The vacant land alone, we could have torn the house down and sold the land for more than what the property was appraised for. It doesn't make sense sometimes. So you need to think of that when you're looking at buying real estate. Will it appraise for the buyer, and will the buyer qualify?
And how long will it take to appreciate before you have some equity in the house, especially if even if you're paying cash? I mean, if you paid $100,000 for a house and is valued at $100,000, let's say you've got the market value for that house as it exists today. At one point, it may have been $250,000, but those days are gone.
Yep.
So you get the house for $100,000. How long will it take before you can make money on that house and it gets to $150,000 and you can make a little bit of money on it? Is it worth the time spent holding it so that you could go ahead and make that money? I think that has to be a concern also.
Oh, absolutely. I tell folks, if you're going to buy real estate, be prepared to own it for at least 5 years, especially if you're thinking about buying a home or moving to a different home. Be very comfortable, very confident that you're going to own that home for at least the next 5 years. And if you're not sure that you're going to live in the same area or that you're going to want to own that property for at least 5 years, then I would pass, regardless of how good the deal might look.
I think the days of fix and flip are not around right now. A lot of people were buying houses on spec, fixing them up, trying to flip them real quickly. I think those days are pretty much gone, don't you? At least for the moment.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not at the same level that right before the real estate bubble popped. Those days are long gone. Are there opportunities there? Sure, but you need to have your game on and know and understand the market in depth and in detail, and the reality is most folks don't. Most of us don't. I don't.
Now, let's get back. I got a couple of other questions here for you, but for the moment, let's get back a little bit to your business and your practice and your clients. Do you have clients all over the country, or are they just pretty much localized there to the Orlando area?
No, surprisingly, we have clients in 17 different states and a couple of foreign countries. While we're located in Central Florida and the majority of our clients are in the Central Florida area, we do have somewhat of a national and a slight international presence. It really just depends on the individual, if they're comfortable with a long-distance relationship, phone, fax, email, internet type of relationship. That's something that we're certainly capable and comfortable with in working with and communicating.
Oh, you mentioned internet. A lot of people, there's a lot of horror stories out there about internet security and so on and so forth. How do you ensure internet security when you're dealing with people that you're not sitting across the table face-to-face with?
Great question. And now, thanks to Bernie Madoff, that question is being asked more and more, as it should be. When it comes to client money and accounts, the best way for anybody to protect themselves from being taken advantage of, especially like a Bernie Madoff type, is just make sure that your money is invested separate from the investment advisor. So what do I mean by that? Well, we are not a brokerage firm for our clients. We use Fidelity, Schwab, or TD Ameritrade. So all of our clients' investments are held at a brokerage account in one of those firms. So they get a monthly statement from those firms. We're the advisor of record, and we get a copy of their statement. So we're able to know what they have and Oftentimes we'll have permission to buy or sell investments in the account, but not withdraw money from the account. So that's a huge, that quite frankly is why people lost money with Bernie Madoff. If they had just had a different brokerage firm separate from his firm, they probably wouldn't have lost any money through the Ponzi scheme. And then what I find is, as far as internet security, the brokerage firms use very sophisticated security protocols to avoid just that, to avoid any security breaches. And we use the same technology when it comes to communicating with clients. Never do we send Social Security numbers or account numbers in their entirety in an email, for instance.
Now, earlier when we started this conversation, you mentioned that you are a fee-based operation. What does that mean?
Yeah, so there's a couple of terms that trip people up. When you hear advisors using the term fee-only, which is what we are a fee-only firm, what that means is the only income, the only revenue source we have is the fees that clients pay us to serve as their trusted advisor. We have a what's called a fiduciary responsibility to put the needs, the interests of our clients ahead of our own. A fee-based financial advisor is, my opinion, perhaps a wolf in sheep's clothing. They want to come across looking like a fee-only advisor, but when they use the term fee-based, that's just industry code for I'm going to charge you a fee, but then I'm also going to sell you stuff that I get a commission from, whether it's insurance, annuities, mutual funds, whatever the case may be. The bottom line is just know and understand what type of advisor that you're working with. I would tell my mother, hire just a fee-only advisor simply because it removes conflicts from the relationship, as many as possible. When somebody's also given advice and collecting a commission based on what you buy or what they sell you, then that just brings in the potential for conflict that oftentimes is just way too great to be exposed to.
So then the people like the Edward Joneses of the world, the others that may be out there, are they fee only or fee based?
No, the Edward Joneses and the Merrill Lynches and Morgan Stanleys of the world, those at best would be fee based. They are definitely not fee only. Years ago, one of our clients brought me a statement. I think it was from Edward Jones. They had sold a mutual fund. They had bought it from a relative who worked for the firm at the time. And back then, one of their advertising claims was, use us because we don't create our own investment products. We don't have the Edward Jones mutual fund like Merrill Lynch does, for instance. So you'll get more unbiased advice from us. Well, I looked at this statement, and at the bottom it said, please refer to our mutual fund disclosure document. And they happened to have a copy of it as well. And in the fine print, literally you had to read it with a magnifying glass. In the fine print, what it said was something to the effect of, while our agents can use and recommend any mutual fund they want, we have, quote, special selling agreements with these 12 different mutual fund companies, and they went on and listed the different mutual fund companies. And, oh, by the way, last year, better than 50% of our net profit came because of these special selling agreements. So when I see firms advertising that, we're unbiased and we don't create our own product, come to us, but yet they don't, in my opinion, fully disclose, oh, by the way, we've got a special selling arrangement that gives us more money than average commission, we get revenue above and beyond the average commission for selling our funds because of this arrangement, and they're not fully disclosing that. That just doesn't seem fair either. And the reality is, unfortunately, the way the law is today, did they break a law? No. But is that the kind of business that you really want to be doing business with?
Yeah. What this is a term that I've heard years ago, and I don't know if it's still apropos for today, but what is churning?
Churning would be buying and selling investments without a reasonable reason or logic behind it, other than to generate another commission transaction for the broker. Most recently, probably an example would be in the area of annuities, especially variable annuities. A broker would sell somebody a variable annuity. Those things have usually a 5 to 7 year early withdrawal penalty. And so along 5 to 7 years later, they go back to that person, hey, we've got a better annuity for you. Let's move you from annuity A to annuity B. Generates another commission for them. Well, it may or may not have been the right thing to do for that customer.
So it's just a method then that the broker can increase their revenue without doing much work.
Yes, my opinion. I'm sure you can find a broker that will disagree with us. But
well, let's get back to where we were. I got a couple more things I want to ask you before we wrap this up. We're getting right down to the short rows, as they say. What is some of the biggest money mistakes that people are making today, be they single or married, whatever?
Well, without a doubt, for couples, the single biggest money mistake a couple makes is usually very common that one spouse handles all the money, handles the investments, and the other spouse has little, if any, knowledge of what's going on. And that's very common, and there's nothing wrong with that on the surface, because you know it's kind of what you do in a marriage. Each of you takes on your area of responsibility and your role, kind of that divide and conquer philosophy. But the problem that you're creating is if you're the person making the investment decisions, and even if your spouse is happy and comfortable with what you've done, the problem can be if your spouse outlives you. So now we've got your spouse, they've survived you, you've passed away, they're not used to making investment decisions, they're now forced to make investment decisions that they probably really would prefer not to be making. And now they have to make those decisions without the person that they would go to, you, for advice, for confirmation that they were doing the right thing. So what a horrible place for a surviving spouse to be. So for couples, both of you, like it or not, both of you have to be involved and know what's going on. You don't have to know all the ins and outs of money and investing, but you have to have a good working knowledge. And certainly, this may sound somewhat self-serving, and certainly if the survivor spouse doesn't have the knowledge or the desire, then certainly you need to have a trusted financial advisor in the picture. And the worst time to hire an advisor is after someone has passed away. Get that person in place now so the two of you can make that decision jointly and have time to get comfortable and build trust with that person. Kind of along the same lines with single folks, again, the biggest mistake is, in this case, not having a sounding board to vet out money moves that you might be thinking about making. So if you can have a mentor, if you will, whether it's a friend or a family member, that really is going to call you on the carpet. They're not going to tell you what you want to hear, but they'll tell you like it is, and combined, if appropriate, with a financial advisor.
Well, Brian, this has been a very fast-paced hour as far as I'm concerned with excellent advice, and I'm sure that anybody that has been listening in, or if they hear it when they hear it in the future, as in the archive shows, this is, I think, timeless advice that you've given today. So I do appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with as far as how to get in touch with you? And let's tell people how they can buy your book, for crying out loud. We barely mentioned the book.
That's just fine. Probably the easiest way to get in touch with me for information about the book. We also have just started a internet TV program, Worry-Free Living TV. Information on all that is at my website, which is my name, BrianFricke.com, BrianFricke.com. Just go to the website. All the information is there on how to get in touch with us, information on the book, on the TV program. And the bottom line is everything that we've done is really so you can make smart choices about your money, so you can do what you want, when you want, where you want.
Well, that's all good information. I've been on your website. I've seen the TV things that you've been doing. They're really interesting. And also your FAQs are certainly interesting as well, and have offering a lot of people a lot of information. So we do again thank you for being with us today, and I guess you can say happy investing.
Thanks, Pete. I think I'm going to go surfing now with the boys.
Have a good time.
All right. Great to be
Thanks
here.
Thanks again.
Bye.
And today you heard the voice and the information and the advice of Mr. Brian Fricke, a certified financial planner, and you can go to his website, and you can also get his information right back here on the archives on Blog Talk Radio. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio in Phoenix, Arizona, where we bring good conversation to the world. And as I said, we brought information and conversation with Brian Fricke, certified financial planner. You can listen to the Boomer the Babe Show every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock, 10 a.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, we do much more than host this radio show. Go to boomandthebabe.com. That's boomerandthebabe.com. See everything that we have going on for us. And go ahead and please join the entrepreneurial revolution so we can all work together on making our own businesses and hopefully helping out the economy, be it local or national, by being the aggressive entrepreneurs that we all need to be in these times. So make sure that you make the second half of your life the best half of your life. And have a great day, everybody, and we will talk to you on the next Boomer and the Babe Show. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Boomer and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.